Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking on urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this edition of City Talks. Today, my guest is Ben Wilson. Ben is the author of a great new book called Metropolis, A History of Humankind's Greatest Invention. Ben, welcome to City Talks.
Hi, great to be here.
So you've written several books on issues relating to liberty and decency, free press, empire. So why a book on cities? And I suppose, given that we're recording it in November 2020, why now when we're in the midst of a pandemic that is causing us to question whether cities are still as important as they maybe were a few months ago? But why a book on cities?
Well, it came out of a lot of my work I've been doing, particularly my last book, which was about sort of global connections in the mid-19th century on the sort of back of the telegraph and steamships and the world kind of coming together. And that was quite urban in the sense of these global connections in the 19th century. So that took me to the idea of global cities, really starting with Shanghai, which I thought was a really interesting city to tell almost the history of the world, as a microcosm of the world, and empire, trade, the sort of war, different changes. And that took me further and further back to look at, what was a global city, and that took me back to cities in general. So it sort of came out of that really kind of, just pulling away the layers and looking at the things. But also, as a historian's point of view, this time in our development marks a key staging point. Obviously, I think everybody knows this figure that we became a majority urban species about 10 years ago, and we're heading to be, even more urbanized in the 21st century to a huge extent. So this seemed to be a good time to sort of tell a much wider, almost history of the world, but using the city as its lens. I thought this was a great time to do that and to look at our kind of current urbanization through history.
So you take a kind of historical perspective, and the book is sort of structured, you've got 14 chapters, broadly chronological. Yeah. You sort of emphasize a city in each chapter, but then broaden out into other different cities as well. I mean, what was it? How did you arrive at that kind of structure? Was it trial and error, or was that always what you had in mind?
Yeah, it kind of was trial and error, because that's quite a dynamic way to write a book, because it kind of leads you. Going back to your earlier question, I'm quite glad I didn't write it during a time of pandemic, because I would have felt like I was doing a selling job on the city. I was trying to justify why we still need cities. So I was able to write a bit about the current pandemic, but if that had been the backdrop to the book, I think it would have been a worse book, because it would have always been looking to say, hey guys, cities are still relevant. I think the book sort of stands alone to answer that question about getting all sort of hot and heavy on the idea of pandemic. And it could be applied to the kind of the current state we're going through. But in terms of the cities I chose, I kind of started at the beginning, the world's first city, the first city we know about for sure, Uruk in modern day Iraq. What I wanted to do was to tell a sort of a history of the world and the history of the city with the city that to me seemed to tell the story of that particular time the best. So it would be hard to write a book like this and ignore Rome, for example. Writing about the Middle Ages, the obvious candidates might have been Venice or Florence, but I wanted to look at cities that told a story. So I chose Lübeck on the Baltic coast of northern Germany, because I thought that told a really, really interesting story about the process of urbanization in places that weren't touched by the Roman Empire. These were new cities of the Middle Ages. So it took me to some sort of less well-known places, but places that seem to me sometimes forgotten, like Malacca and in the Straits of Malacca, places like that that were burnt bright in their time and maybe we've forgotten. So yeah, the cities had to tell me something about the time, something about how cities were changing, and to draw a story out of that. So the book sort of starts at a kind of local level of looking at these cities without telling a kind of complete history of them, but it will lead on to sort of bigger themes about urbanization.
I mean, interestingly, kind of when you look through the cities that you highlight, as you say, they're sort of symbolic of their time. Babylon, Uruk, you said, Alexandria, Constantinople, even Rome to a degree, Baghdad. Particularly some of those more ancient cities, they've kind of fallen away in their you know, in their significance. And I wonder what, you know, I wonder what you make of that, in a sense that, you know, often we think about, you know, the success of a city as being somewhat permanent and, you know, it's always there and it's always been there. But actually, as you say, some of the very global cities that were dominant in their time are, even if they still exist, they're less dominant now. Is that significant? I mean, how do you kind of make sense of that?
Well, it's a long history, right, of urbanization. What's an interesting, what I just thought about when you're asking that question, actually, was if you do a kind of chronological sweep of the book and you see the midway point, you reach Babylon. You know, those cities that are now quite obscure to us, like Uruk and Babylon, had an extraordinary longevity, really, really long time. And what did for them, and this is to your significance point, what did for them really, you know, those very early cities was climate change. They became unsustainable. Some of the cities that, you know, that they're sort of decline, it's very hard to kill a city, you know, even when everything's been thrown at them. I think, you know, in the Second World War and sort of conditions of almost total destruction, there's always a sort of bit of root that keeps on growing back. They're really hard. The Romans knew this when they destroyed Carthage. They had to completely take everybody out, sell them into slavery, and plow over the ruins of a burnt city in order, because they knew that cities were able to bounce back quite well. But I agree, you know, that some of the cities that were big in this book, you know, were suffered from the over the long period of history. The things that have changed cities have been a shifting way of trade routes, maybe climate change, like I just mentioned. Very rarely a kind of a big, you know, man-made disaster. Very rarely, in fact. But they will, over time, cities do fall from grace, and that is relevant. But they're capable of bouncing back. Amsterdam was the kind of the sort of premier global metropolis of the 17th century, and it went into a long period of decline. And now it's kind of bidding back to be, as you know, a major global city, and has even bigger ambitions. So cities do go through these kind of ups and downs, which is something I want to highlight in the book. It's not a sort of linear process of the triumph of cities. It is the fact that that by their interest often lies in telling us a bigger story about the history of the world.
Yeah, because in the book, you know, it's very you know, you connect it to the sort of growth and expansion of you know, civilization or civilized areas and empires as well. In a sense, you know, the Alexandrian Persian Empire is very, you know, those two things are intertwined, and Rome and the Roman Empire, obviously the Hellenic Empire, and, you know, the emergence of the Greek city states as well. So they're both driving and responding to those sorts of phenomena.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is a fascinating, if you take the sort of the long view, you can kind of almost track where the balance of power lies in the world, where great cities were. I think you know, some cities that didn't make it, that we kind of forget about, were maybe Central Asia, the Indian Ocean. These are great kind of urbanized places when Europe was really sort of de-urbanized after the fall of the Roman Empire. The whole sort of gravity of an energy of urbanization does track east and exists in the kind of string of cities that connect from Baghdad through to China. Some sort of great cosmopolitan cities that contained, you know, a really interesting mix of people that we kind of tend to forget about, along, you know, stretching through the Indian coast, the Straits, Southeast Asia, with cities that contained populations of Hindus, Buddhists, Jews, Christians, Muslim, Confucian, a whole sort of range of people. They're very open cosmopolitan cities that exchanged the kind of the wealth of the world for what we used to call the Dark Ages, but it was certainly a time when there were very few cities of over 10,000 people in Europe. These were some huge kind of cities of 100,000 plus that connected the world by land and sea in across Asia. That's something we kind of forget about, because those cities were kind of undone after the kind of the Portuguese intrusion into the Indian Ocean and the Spanish sort of conquest of the Americas and the crossing the Pacific, that there was a sort of decline, and some of these cities became very obscure and very small, but they suffered from a big shift in global change. And then you see the rise of a city like Lisbon or later Amsterdam. And that's an interesting story. And you can almost, and I follow it in the book through looking at the sort of commodities. A shipwreck in Indonesia can tell us a story about global trade that connects Baghdad, just as the goods that were on display in Lisbon and Amsterdam tell us a sort of story of a very dynamic exchange of goods and things that were really, these are the sort of city builders, these kind of these golden threads of trade that go around the world. And you can, you know, it's interesting to use that as a prism through which to look at history and empire.
Yeah, no, I think there's a stat you quote in the book during the Middle Ages. I think 19 out of the 20 biggest cities were part of the kind of Muslim or the China empires, obviously the one being Constantinople, but in a sense everywhere else was, you know, was not what we would typically or traditionally think about. Obviously, you know, we're in Europe, we think of a very kind of European or start from a very European perspective.
Yeah, and I wanted to take that, sort of move that focus a bit. These huge, very sophisticated cities, like, you know, in Central America, maybe, you know, and in West Africa, which really do get forgotten, even from those lists of sort of big cities. They're kind of, they are sort of fairly obscure. But yeah, it is a striking fact how long it took for Europe sort of to catch up again in that kind of, you know, it's not quite a sort of race, but a kind of, or top 10 or top 100, but it's an interesting, it shows where energy was. And, you know, those kind of cities of Central Asia were pivotal in the exchange of knowledge of these worlds of the Chinese civilizations, Indian civilizations, the ancient Greek civilizations, which used to thrive in Central Asia, connecting them to Baghdad, the hinge point of this world. So it was a great transmission of ideas from the Mediterranean through to the far east of Asia. So it's fascinating. These cities were highly technological cities like Merv in Central Asia or Bukhara were incredible places of knowledge because they were literal crossroads. So they exchanged knowledge. So a lot of our ideas, a lot of the ideas about mathematics that influenced the Renaissance streamed through this very urbanized network of Asia. To me, that's fascinating because it, you know, especially looking at it as an urban phenomenon, and that only kind of comes back into Europe through a long time and a long process of exchange and acceptance of those ideas. And then that in its turn only comes when Europe is beginning to kind of re-urbanize from about the 13th century.
And it very much connects with that, you know, that long term and long role that cities have played, which is, you know, as centers of learning, as centers of knowledge, centers of development, centers of, you know, new thinking, which is definitely one of the kind of themes that you draw brilliantly in the book, in a sense of play, you know, Baghdad and, you know, Babylon back in the day, you know, they were where they essentially brought the very latest knowledge almost from, you know, from around the globe, but certainly from in their regions to bear in their places and built brilliant libraries and fantastic, you know, centers of learning.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's, you know, that the energies of those things come partly from the exchange of people and ideas. And I kind of write about cities almost being this kind of accelerating point in human history based on a few conditions. You know, going back to the very first city of Uruk, that's a city that kind of emerged in the marshes of what's now southern Iraq. And that's kind of our origin point of urbanization is a kind of very soggy, marshy kind of one. But what it did was bring people together for the first time in creating density, which nowadays we talk about a sort of clustering effect of people coming together, but the very idea of bringing human brains into close proximity mean a staggering acceleration in human life in the city in the fourth, third millennia BC. So, you know, once you've got people living in proximity and working together and exchanging ideas and people coming from across the Fertile Crescent in the Middle East, you get things like the invention of writing, numbers, mathematics, accounting, money, and writing being the kind of key part of that. So cities do have this kind of incredible effect of kind of speeding up change, which is why they're worth looking at. You know, another example might be London in the late 17th century when coffee houses become a kind of, you know, that creates a kind of informal network within the city, a place where people can meet and interact, which was very new in cities to have that kind of public space that was open to all comers, sort of a public private space where people could come together. So in the late 17th century London, you'd have, you know, scientists meeting businessmen and long distance traders and writers. And you know, it was a kind of connection of a scientific revolution and a commercial revolution, which was created, another sort of fast pace of change. And so London sort of sucks a lot of energy out of Amsterdam, which previously held that mantle of a place of intense immigration and people coming in and exchanging ideas and igniting these changes. In the case of Amsterdam, it was the beginning of the stock exchange, which is kind of a very moment in London. It was the creation of a sort of modern capitalism almost, that was kind of done over a cup of coffee in these coffee houses to create this kind of wonderfully dynamic informal space, which we're sort of inheritors of now in a way. But you know, we have these things, and cities do have that kind of incredible effect of bringing people together. And it is often, the successful cities are ones that welcome people in and encourage these exchange of ideas in whatever way, whether it's over a coffee house or a library like Alexandria. You know, once you create this kind of space for that to happen, things can change very quickly. And that's why the cities really are the motor of our development. And
yeah,
sort of a Rook almost serves as an overture to the book, because that's the sort of first early moment of kind of incredible change. And then that sort of process sort of continues within cities, and cities kind of become the place where humanity kind of makes these big advances, but also, as in the case of a Rook, which not only invented the written word, but kind of invented slavery, kingship, tyranny, organized armies, that, you know, good and bad things come from cities. It's not a sort of story of kind of rosy triumph all the time. It's a story of good and the bad mixed together. Yeah. But certainly cities have been instrumental in our change and development, and there's every reason to say that will continue in the future.
Yeah, no, I want to pick up and explore some of those, because as well as the sort of chronological approach that you have in the book, you introduce real, you know, interesting themes, or take certain aspects like, you know, coffee and coffee houses and how that relates to London, or food and markets and how that relates to places like Baghdad. I want to come back to that and just get you to say a little bit more about those kind of things. I suppose in your kind of reading of it and writing of it, are cities somewhat inevitable, you know, in a sense, because of the human condition, that once you get enough humans on the planet, you know, cities are a natural phenomenon and a natural occurrence because of their desire to come together? Is that the way that you think of it?
Sort of, yeah. I think they do become inevitable. I think it's interesting that, you know, a place like Britain, for example, was quite resistant to the idea of cities until the Romans arrived. And the city was kind of a Mediterranean ideal of the city was imposed on not just Britain, but other parts of Northern Europe. And they were abandoned pretty quickly when the Romans left.
Yeah.
That's, to me, quite interesting. It's sort of, you know, the city seemed to me to be necessary when there is sort of cross-continental and beyond continental trade. That seems to be the motor for me, that there was always this sort of theme in the early parts of the book, was that cities that were connected to a flow of trade that goes from China through to maybe Western Europe in one form or of another, that creates the conditions for cities. It seemed to me that always that was the city builder, was this tapping into this kind of flow of trade. But I think, yeah, for the very early, for the Mesopotamians, the city was almost a miracle. It was a sort of gift of the gods, because they saw how much it changed. That was, to them, that was sort of fascinating. It was a real kind of gift, and they distinguished them. It was a thing that distinguished them from what they would see as barbarians and nomads and tribespeople, was this gift that had been given to by the gods. So they kind of cherished cities in a way, saw them as a very sacred place. Other cultures have the same kind of regard for cities. Whether it's inevitable or not, I'm not sure, because we do, yeah, lots of people have a kind of resistance to cities. They can be very, very, you know, dark and unpleasant places. And as much as we kind of flock to cities for their wealth and opportunities, we also try and flee from them. And we found lots of different ways to do that, whether it's, you know, suburbanization or kind of, you know, sort of hatred of the city, that people seem to see it as a place of darkness and sin and death and disease and crime and slavery. And that goes back, you know, in Christianity and Judaism, in striking contrast, the Mesopotamians, for them, the paradise in the beginnings was a garden, and the end was a sort of celestial city, but in the middle is a kind of city which is created in contravention of God's rules, and all the bad, all the sin sort of happens in cities. And so cities get a very bad press throughout the ages. It's always a kind
of... Yeah, no, I think that it's fascinating, the deep sort of historical roots as to... You know, the degree to which different places or different countries, different civilizations are, you know, are pro-urban or anti-urban. And you allude to the, I think in some of it, that, you know, close to home in Britain, I think we've always had a kind of ambivalence to, if not a kind of anti-perspective to cities. We emphasize the, you know, the bad, and therefore we need to control them and limit them, rather than, you know, as you say, in some of the other cultures and civilizations, and much more of it became a central, you know, it was the pinnacle of civilization, the pinnacle of humanity was, you know, was the city itself, not just from a religious point of view, but from a civic point of view, from a knowledge point of view, from a cultural point of view.
Yeah, I think Britain's a good example of a country that's, well, there's two ways to look at that, actually. I was just thinking that partly, you know, we're very kind of landed dominated society in comparison to certain parts of Germany, for example, where there was a sort of civic elite that really defined itself against the countryside and against big territorial rulers. In England, for sure, there's a much more sort of veneration of the land and a domination of city by landed elites. So the corollary to that is that there's a kind of creating aspects of the countryside in the city, which is particularly English, almost trying to create sort of aspects of the country estate in certain parts of London and elsewhere. Another really good example, I think, is the United States, which for various reasons kind of found the city very, very problematic. If you look at the colonial city was in the 18th century was kind of almost created as an antidote to European cities that had got too big and too dangerous and too vice-ridden, that there was an idea that in the new world you could connect countryside and city in a much more kind of, you had more room for it and you could have a lifestyle that was simultaneously urban and rural. And you get, you know, the whole sort of process of American suburbanization, which has been a massive impact on urbanization and the way that cities have developed from the late 19th century onwards, really, is a kind of legacy of that deep historical sort of antipathy to cities or an attempt to rebuild cities in the new world. And what do you get? You know, you get a kind of an attempt to have a, you know, a semi-rural, not quite urban existence, but then you kind of kill the thing that you love by splurging onwards and onwards and onwards into the countryside.
Yeah, I get a sense in the book, Ben, that you tell me if I'm wrong, but I get a sense in the book that I'm not a big fan of suburbs and suburbia.
Well, no, I'm...
Am I right or am I wrong?
You're right and sort of
wrong. I'm wrong.
I'm fascinated by suburbs. Suburbs, you know, like take me to a suburb. I find them really, really interesting. I think because they register change so dramatically. I found Los Angeles really, I was sort of dreading going to Los Angeles because it's a hard city to get around, especially if you're European, right? But I found I had the most fascinating few weeks in LA just exploring different neighborhoods and registering. They were fascinating to me as a historian because they've changed so much over 60, 70 years, or maybe even less than that. And you can register the changes if you kind of know what you're, if you have an inkling of what you're looking for. You can trace a history of the Cold War, of immigration into America, of changing society, changing technologies. You can do the same in London suburbs. I think nowhere has changed more probably than the inner and some of the outer suburbs of London in terms of their changing demographics and their changing relationship to the city. So I'm not suburban at all because I take a sort of enjoyment in them. But what I do take exception to, and what I kind of, the point of the book is, suburbia by its nature, or sprawl by its nature, is very destructive of the planet and is very destructive of human communities and often human health. You know, there's a problem of obesity that's associated with suburbs and the kind of car dependent lifestyles that go with them. So that's what I take exception to. I don't like the sort of the antipathy you take from the book. I think is the fact that although, you know, the urban population of the world is increasing on a massive scale, but even faster growing is the footprint of cities. And I think that's deep, you know, that can't not deeply alarm us, because they're cities of growing like that are growing into some of the most important biodiversity hotspots in the world and will cause huge problems in terms of climate change and will in the end make those very cities unsustainable when they kind of soar off the branch on which they're sitting. I think there's a really important connection between cities and environment that we've been able to ignore for a long time, or at least since the Industrial Revolution and long supply chains, that the city doesn't seem to exist in its own environment anymore. It becomes much more of a kind of global thing that's kind of almost outside nature.
Yeah.
And if we, you know, the more we kind of intrude into nature and unthinkingly kind of desire space, we cause ourselves problems. And the sort of the essence of the urban that I see is urban is in the sense of somewhere, you know, things that are walkable, have a center to them, have a kind of urbane lifestyle, which is often missing from suburbs. But there's no reason to think that urbanism does that done well can look back at the, because some of the things I'm writing about, the things that make city living pleasurable and enjoyable, can't be, you know, reintegrated into fast-growing cities, and, you know, and sort of put a some kind of check on this kind of out of control urban growth, which is a serious problem.
And I think you say in the book around, you know, the sort of urban form, or the choice around urban form that Africa and African cities take, and Indian and India cities take, whether they sprawl out in the kind of US model, or maybe try to be denser in the sort of the Japan and some of the older European model, will have a huge impact on, you know, climate change and environmental distress over the next decade and over the next a century and beyond. I think, you know, you highlight those kind of things really well. I want to just to get you to say a little bit more. You touched on it a few minutes ago when we were talking about, you know, the significance of coffee houses and cafes in London. You know, it's an emergence in London, how significant. And, you know, you sort of highlight in part in London, they started as coffee houses, and then actually, you know, they became private clubs, you know, in a sense, that shift away from public and open to, you know, to private, and which is partly to do with class, you know, class structure and all the rest of it. But the other one I want you to say a little bit about, because I just found it fascinating, it's a brilliant chapter, is about the significance of public baths and bathing and Rome. Can you just, firstly, tell us, you know, give us the scale of how, you know, it seems to me that everybody in Rome was basically bathing, you know, pretty much every day, not for cleanliness reasons, but for other reasons. But just tell us how you use that or to get into the sort of under the skin of Rome as a place and how it functioned.
Yeah, no, I was really, this was a really fun bit of the book to research and to write about. And it was partly not seeking, the approach I had to that chapter was partly not sort of seeking the obvious. I didn't want to write about the Romes and forums and, you know, great moments, lots of marble and sort of classical architecture. Yeah. But I also, what I wanted to look about, the approach I took to Rome was, here was a city of close to 1 million people, maybe even more than 1 million people in its heyday. Unprecedented in the history of the world. Very, very densely populated, very polluted. And most people didn't live in nice villas. They lived in insulare, which was sort of the version of high rises, which were very rickety, very smelly, very congested, and very hard to live in. It's a sort of classic example of people paying very, very high rents to live in small places in powerful cities. So what's the kind of compensation? How do people survive that? And how do people, you know, survive that, the cauldron of a big city, was one of the questions I wanted to ask in the book. And here was a very, very early example of one. So it kind of took me to the bathhouses, which were, after all, the kind of symbol and standard bearer of Roman urban civilization as it pushed into, you know, wild and remote places like Britain, that the bath always came with them. So these kind of great bathhouses in Rome were open to the public. It was like going to an art gallery or a museum or a library and a gym and a spa all rolled into one. And this was part of a daily ritual of Roman life that occurred in the afternoon. It was intensely sociable. That was really its probably main purpose of bringing a city together, almost in a kind of common purpose. It sits alongside amphitheaters and arenas, as, you know, where you can see gladiatorial combats and horse races and things like that, as a really interesting development in cities, that it was, the cities weren't just about the sacred or the displays of power, but they were responding to citizen needs in a way that the city had to be made livable and bearable and pleasant. This was what the Romans called voluptus, which is this sort of enjoyment of pleasure and the good things in life. And it's what separated Romans from what they call barbarians or sort of simple-minded, and again, in their kind of definition, rural people. This was the mark of urbanity. And it was almost, you know, in a place like Britain, maybe, or Gaul, that when they wanted to Romanize local populations, the bath was important. It was almost like you washed away your kind of your backward barbarianism in the bathhouse and became civilized in this place. So there's that connection. And another thing I wanted to look at, and look at more broadly, as a phenomenon of urbanization, which is, you know, how do you survive the city? And we forget, in an age of private bathrooms, how fundamental cleanliness and bathing is. And to me, baths seem to me to be almost the opposite of city life, that in the city you get pushed and prodded and kept in, pushed around in crowds. You have to contort your body. You have to dress in a way that kind of signifies who you are in a society. And yes, you're very constrained, where bathing was the opposite. It's done naked, so it erases those kind of those distinctions. You can move your body in a free way, and it connects to something that's quite primal. Water, you know, is a kind of connection in a very, very intensely urban atmosphere. Having that feel of water on skin was a kind of was a way out of the city. So I kind of looked at how bathing, you know, reasserts itself in other big cities. It's striking to me that the next sort of urban culture after Rome to have a city of over 1 million people was Britain. And that was the next kind of European country to really institute public baths again. Other cities that were carried on to big, so go back to our previous sort of theme of Asian cities, was the Islamic Hammam was important as the kind of the sort of centerpiece of urban sociability in a lot of cities. In Japan, the Senso baths were really important in establishing a kind of communal aspect to civic life, and they drop out of Europe, and it's just almost a sign of urban health, is that ability to swim. And I felt that was again a story that we'd lost because we all just do it in our bathrooms at home. So I looked at kind of wild swimming in cities and how important that was to a city like London, that people really did cherish walking out and swimming in streams and ponds around London right up to the 19th century, or swimming in the Thames, and in New York swimming in the Hudson and East Rivers was the working class leisure activity in a city that was hot, congested, had very little open public space, that the water becomes almost like a commons. People fought for their right to swim against what we would call gentrification, but then would be called a kind of an attack on working class pleasures, or an attack on nakedness and nudity and indecency. And then in the 1930s, one of the kind of great things that came out of the Depression and the New Deal was these kind of raft of huge amount of new open air swimming pools across New York and across all American cities. And it was the biggest leisure activity. That in the cinema in the 1930s was huge. And it was a very contested, very cherished aspect of city life. London, you know, the dream of London was to have a Lido within walking distance of everybody. So, you know, that was a sort of almost, you know, forgotten story of the city in a way, that this desire to swim is not just about cleanliness. It's about being free, being, you know, able to have leisure in a really intense thing. So I found this sort of like chain of thought that began with Rome, and what made Rome a successful or livable city then sort of became a story that, you know, recreated something I felt had been forgotten from the history.
Yeah, no,
I've been swimming around, you know, in as many cities as I can. I try to swim, so I've, you know, swam in the water in Helsinki in the middle of, you know, the new year, which is a great experience. I've swam in the lakes of Berlin and experienced that sort of joy of kind of urban life, as, you know, almost in heat waves, and millions of Berliners troop off to the tons of lakes. And it's a really delicious experience to step away from the city and into water. So it's become a sort of rather favorite hobby of mine.
So you're not only writing about it, you're actually doing it as well, which is
living it,
which is incredible. No, I thought that theme was fantastic. The other theme, just to get you to say a little bit about, because again, I think it's a wonderful theme that runs through the book, you know, is the issue around food, and particularly street food, and how that's connected to the markets.
Yeah,
you know, in different places and at different times, and the sort of significance and importance of both the food on the one hand, but actually again the kind of public space and public interaction that is encouraged and facilitated by street markets in different. Just say a little bit more about that. Why that was something you wanted to write about?
Yeah, no, I really found that interesting. I think it's, you know, if you go to cities in the developing world, more, you know, cities that are under a lot more pressure than us, that getting food and shopping and going to the market is a key part of life. It kind of reminds us the looking for, you know, procuring food for the day and traversing the city looking for food is a really, really sort of fundamental part of going out into the world and being a participant in urban life. I was kind of interested, the thing that sparked it, it was a bit like the baths in Rome, was the idea of Baghdad as a city of street food and markets. And Baghdad was kind of, it was a created city, and it's almost an imperial and religious city that brought together people from all over the Islamic world. And what do people do when they move to a city? They bring their food with them. Something we know kind of well enough, that cities do this kind of incredible range of cuisine, and that incomers to the city, kind of the way to a city's heart is through its food. And that's how, you know, you build businesses, you build lives. And Baghdad was no exception to that. And I was interested that Baghdad was a city that kind of brought, was a city that cherished books and things like that. But what they really loved was cookery books and kind of poets that would specialize in sort of, you know, celebrating food and these wonderful cookbooks. And then a wonderful kind of street food culture that, you know, people cooking on the side of the streets and producing it and trying to outdo it in an intensely kind of food orientated city. They were trying to outdo each other to cook the best food, to the extent that some of the caliphs would dress up in disguise and slip out and go and eat on the street, or, you know, or do their best to get hold of this kind of amazing street food. And it's a reminder that for most of history, and especially for working people, most food was eaten in the street. It was integral to the sociability of all cities. We have a kind of, you know, in our own age, a kind of revival in street food, but it's a kind of almost, it's a sort of parody of what was once a kind of necessity and often quite a delicious kind of way of experiencing the city, especially kind of what we might call ethnic food, and how that kind of influenced food cultures in London, New York in particular, with the sort of introductions of pretzels, hamburgers, bagels, pizzas, ice creams, all these things that just, you know, were, and to a certain extent still are, the kind of characteristics of a city, as a place where you kind of eat your way around the city and explore it in a kind of gastronomic sense. I thought it was really interesting, but it sort of focuses on Baghdad because I just found that what I wanted to talk about Baghdad was the crossroads of the world.
Yes.
World of knowledge, but it was also a kind of crossroads of cuisines. They're really interesting. Modern day Los Angeles is interesting because a lot of what's changed the kind of the character of the city has been these food trucks that have become immensely popular over the last decade or so, maybe a bit longer. There's a real culture of it, and people will go and seek out, use blogs and social media to find the best, most innovative lunch trucks. And that in turn changes the character of the street, that people will go there, then someone will play music. And then there will be informal street sellers, and then there'll be a party atmosphere. And a city that was sort of built around cars and transport, suddenly a bit of life and color comes back to the city streets. And it's really interesting that food plays such an important role in a city, in a city's life. I thought that needed to be kind of, we needed in a, you know, an age where we, you know, go and spend £15 on a burger in a street food van, or we go to the supermarket, we miss out on that quite rich experience of street life as it's acted out in a marketplace, that it's easy for us to forget that. We live in quite sanitized cities in a way that kind of don't have room for that kind of, or much less of a room for that informal aspect, which is kind of the lifeblood of a lot of cities. And I kind of, you know, it's an interesting thing that you participate in the world by participating in that kind of rough and tumble of the street. And the street is often a place of food and refreshment.
Yeah, no, quite. One more theme, just to get you to say a little bit more, because again, I just found it fascinating to, you know, we talk about, you know, the virtue of cities and how they, you know, they're the pinnacle of human creativity and, you know, and civilization, et cetera, but you also highlight in the book, you know, in a sense, the city as the place of vice.
Yeah,
you know, of people coming to cities for, you know, to for entertainment, and that entertainment can be, you know, it can be alcohol, it can be drugs, but also coming, you know, for sex and, you know, and those kind of different experiences as well. Just say a little bit more around that. You know, the city is the vice.
Yeah, well, yes, exactly. I mean, it's cities are food, coffee, bathing, you know, you name it. They are sensual places, and that's part of their kind of enduring attraction. They're not just places to go and get rich in. They're places to experience something bigger and bigger than yourself.
Yeah.
They're going back to those early Mesopotamian cities. There's a lot, you know, it was a very, seems to be a kind of, not, I don't know, it's difficult to say an openness about sex, but a sort of, certainly they were very interested in it. It seemed to be a hallmark of of the city and the city, what cities do for throughout all time. This is what it said to me, really, without knowing much about the sex lives of the Mesopotamians, was, you know, it's a reflection that how important cities are in our kind of sexuality and our sexual development, that, you know, forms of life that are impossible in a village or a small society, that, you know, is possible in the city because of the kind of the anonymity it provides, the cover, the darkness, the space, urban space can be reused for these kind of things. So cities have always been seen as intensely kind of sexual, you know, through the middle ages. There were lots of street names that were quite sort of offensive at the time, but it suggested what was going on there, these dark alleyways of you know, depravity. And that's kind of what gave Babylon a bad name, was, you know, not, it wasn't, probably wasn't more kind of sexually interesting, you know, interesting than any other time, but it just happened to be the place that the Jews were taken in captivity after they were taken out of Jerusalem. And they saw it as a punishment from God to be taken to this terrible city. And what they saw was sex and vice and depravity. And it became a kind of, you know, we use Babylon, word, you know, Babylon is a byword for the depravity of cities. But one man's depravity is another man's freedom, or woman's freedom. And mainly men, I think, through history. It's more, only more recently, that it's the other way around. But people celebrated it and condemned it in equal measure. But it's always been there. There's been a long history of homosexuality and other forms of sexuality that for a long time were tabooed and illegal and punished, but had a kind of flourishing in cities and was either secret or open. There's a really long connection that in literature and art. And it's, you know, I think that's interesting in and of itself. It's an alternate history of the city to see it in those terms. It's an alternate history of humanity as well to see it in those terms of what's permissible and what isn't, what becomes a sort of a delicious vice because it's underground, and what becomes more acceptable to the mainstream because it has a toleration in cities. Cities tend to be more tolerant places in the end because people have to rub up and jostle against each other and sort of accept what might otherwise be seen as deviant behavior. So yes, it's a really interesting thing, but at the same time, our sort of human beings' attitude to sex is such that when we see it kind of see things we don't like enacted in the publicity of the city, it makes us feel, you know, not us, it takes lots of people, moralists throughout history, revolted by the city, and to see them entirely sexualized and yes, of debauching people, demoralizing them, in the sense of taking away their morality. And it's a place where true morality can't really be enacted because everyone's going to be corrupted into this thing, because people have always seen it throughout history is that people are only restrained from vice by being watched. In the city, if there's no eyes, there's no kind of restraint, so people can kind of enact this. And so it's a repeated thing throughout history, the thing of the city as dark, dangerous, a bit sort of seedy and disgusting. And it is, that kind of criticism is often done through that lens of sex. So that seemed to me to be a really interesting kind of way of approaching our longer term attitudes towards cities.
Fascinating to follow that theme and through the book. Now I got your attitude towards suburbia wrong, or at least not entirely correct. Let me have a go at another sort of theme that I felt was coming through the book, or frustration from you that was in the book, and this is the one around, you know, attempts to instill order and structure, often in the physical sense of, you know, taking down streets and older streets and putting in straight roads, you know, the kind of, you know, the attempts that we've seen, you know, the Roman cities were, you know, very much designed on the grid fashion, as were, you know, modern American cities. Haussmann, obviously, and Corbusier in Paris, kind of familiar with those sorts of things. My sense in the book is that you're not a big fan of that. You know, am I right on that one?
Well, grant you that one, yes.
Right. So say a little bit more about, you know, your kind of, you know, what it is about it that you don't like.
Well, I was interested. I went to a city that you and many of your listeners would probably have heard of, even if not been to, Songdo in South Korea, which is a brand new city, brand new smart city, supposedly the kind of, you know, the kind of the prototype and the most sort of obvious example of or showy example of modern technologies. And I was struck when I was there that here was a kind of brand new city designed designed to sort of answer a lot of urban problems. And I sat there, so I had several reflections. One was, this is a reflection, this is a kind of what people are trying to be doing throughout history, which is to impose order on something that's inherently chaotic. And to make the city should be make us better whilst they kind of deprave us. So if we did something right, they will make us better people. Only if you can get it right, then there'll be better cities. The other thing I thought was, I'd like to come back here in 100 years' time, because what human beings are very good at doing is repurposing cities and inhabiting them and doing something that's completely different from the original intention. And I kind of almost began to find that in Songdo, which I found sort of dead by night. I found the bar district, and I found people animating the city from the ground up. So it was a city, it was a place I found lots of reflections, which probably weren't the ones I was going to get, where I was sort of expecting computer chips and sensors. But what I found was a sort of city that, you know, brought these lots of reflections. And it really goes back, you know, to what I was saying before, that the city, you know, that in the Bible, the kind of the end point is the city, you know, the sort of perfected city of Jerusalem. That's the kind of the glorious city. And it's a sort of, that's a dream that's animated people, whether they're Judaic Christian or not, throughout history, is this attempt to build better and to design better and to make people better through the places they live. But what I really sort of found, and what I sort of hold to, is that cities, the best cities are the ones, you know, like my reflections on Songdo, are the ones that grow incrementally and have been and create these layers of history and complexity, which kind of runs contrary to any kind of planning. And in a way, any kind of planning kind of risks deadening that effect of spontaneity. One of the examples I sort of looked at was the way that Tokyo recovered from the utter devastation of the Second World War, which was very in striking contrast to a lot of Europe. And then post-war development in America was where there was a desire, sort of, you know, a sort of utopian desire almost to re-engineer cities and modernize them. Tokyo was rebuilt neighborhood by neighborhood or individual by individual from the ground up, built up for almost what we might almost as a sort of jerry-built slum-like area into a kind of very gleaming modern city, sort of incrementally, stage by stage, through the late 40s, 50s and 60s. I found that fascinating as a way that you could connect the kind of the incremental growth with sort of modernity, and very different from this kind of dream that really does run through history of knocking down and building and being very contrary to what I see as the sort of the heart of the city, which is that human ecosystem of relationships and purposes and mixed uses and sort of messiness that kind of creates in the city. Messy in the sense that it's not ordered, but that's where you get your sort of the things that I sort of celebrate in the book almost, of the kind of the creativity and energy of cities comes from this spontaneity and unpredictable interactions at street level. So yes, you detected that absolutely right, but we are absolutely besotted through Hollywood, through ancient writers who wanted to create the perfect city, and designers, engineers, you know, we are really preoccupied with this, and the temptation is so great that it seems to be a thing that's enacted throughout history and in all ages, that there's a sort of real sort of desire that if we can only get it right this one time, we'll pull it off. But actually, the sort of dynamism to me seems to come from humans, not from buildings as such. Not to say that there shouldn't be an absence of planning, but what you should be really careful about is not killing that street life, that kind of, or that sort of informal sort of bizarre unpredictability and sort of spontaneity that cities bring. And that's where I took my starting point. And as I was kind of sitting, sort of observing this kind of incredible sort of half empty city of Songdo in South Korea, it was, you know, prompted these kind of reflections. It was a good place to go and sit and think about these.
Yeah, no, quite. Well, I know it's a perfect, everybody's seen the sort of designs that Wren introduced that he wanted to do to London after the Great Fire, which were thankfully, in my opinion at least, weren't enacted in any serious way. And you have a sort of a lament in the book about some of the negative effects on the centre of Paris, at least by introducing these very large, hugely kind of automobile dominated boulevards, which were done for, you know, partly to cleanse the city in a broader sense. And the higgledy-piggledy and messiness that that was lost as a result of that, or, you know, how Warsaw, and obviously the complete destruction of Warsaw, but the old town that was left, how you compare that to the new town, which is much, much more brutalistic in its architecture and design. I think it's just a, it's a fantastic kind of ongoing theme about a desire to make our cities ordered and planned versus to rejoice in their messiness and their, you know, their complexity. Just to come to, I could talk to you for hours on end, Ben, but just, I mean, you say in the book, and actually you said it earlier on, you know, we're a, you know, we're an urban species. I mean, living in cities has actually changed us, and it's changed wildlife. I think you make the points towards the back of the book, how we kind of respond. So, you know, we're an urban species, but I suppose it partly is, you know, have we lost, what have we lost the ability to live in cities? Have we kind of forgotten what it is and what we need to be and how we need to be in order to be comfortable with cities, or not? What's your sort of reflection on where we are now, given, you know, majority urban, you know, the future is mega cities of Lagos and Tokyo and others? I mean, what's your kind of look into the future about how we'll interact with our cities in the future?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think to a certain point, we are good at living in cities. People are very resilient. Cities bring out a kind of resilience and energy in us that, you know, they are super productive places, whether you're talking about on a kind of global scale where most global productivity comes from a handful of cities, but also on a very individual level, the pressure of arriving as a rural migrant, maybe in a city like Mumbai or Lagos, it encourages a kind of, whether you like it or not, a kind of survival instinct that makes people very energetic. So we are good at doing that. And you go to, two cities I did go to, Lagos and Mumbai, where you see an awful lot of misery and poverty, but you also see a lot of energy that comes from street level up. And you see that in lots of different ways. I went to a place called a computer village in Lagos that started as a handful of computer geeks working on the street in a market, and now has a daily turnover of $5 million a day, which isn't insignificant. Or you see it in sort of recycling schemes in Davari in Mumbai. Really, really interesting. So we're good at that aspect of city living for sure. I think what the current pandemic has shown, I think, in that we've sort of hollowed out our city centres to a certain extent from two big forces that have suffered the most from the pandemic, which is to say tourism and commuting, that they lack resilience because they only have one very small amounts of, you know, very unmixed use of things. So they've become very reliant on a few things that when they go away, plunge those places into chaos. When people now talk about the chaos, you know, they're pessimistic about the city. They're really pessimistic, I think, about the centres of cities that we have deliberately hollowed out and have, you know, made into the sort of playgrounds of very, very rich people. So I think there's a lot of vitality in cities. I think the biggest thing I saw for hope for the future of cities and why they're going to be hopefully more attractive places is that cities are becoming greener over the last time, and there's every indication that's going to continue, that the nature provides the best defense against our destruction of nature in a way, that trees cool cities, wetlands suck up water, and it makes cities much more strikingly biodiverse than we ever thought they were or they ever were during our sort of industrial period. So the signs of hope there, wetlands being restored, trees being planted, cities are adaptable. I kind of, you know, I sort of make that point that they're kind of very good at surviving, very good at, you know, ensuring their own survival as well, in often very surprising ways. But I think the way they're ensuring their survival now is by kind of trying to find this accommodation and better balance with nature. And I really hope that continues. And I hope the pandemic, if anything, makes that an even more important and urgent thing to do. And it kind of, you know, it goes back to something that we forget about cities. The cities were places of immense diversity and ecological things it's a sort of story that hasn't been told about cities in a way, that how green they used to be. We forgot, people didn't like it, so they kind of didn't tell that story, but now we kind of like it and we want that. We're talking about messiness. The kind of messiness that I'd encourage would be a kind of wilding of cities, not a kind of cultivation of park-like plants and very sort of sterile green spaces, but very lush spaces. And that means wild, and that kind of means messy, because that's what nature is. So to get back to my messiness point, so I kind of, yeah, I see that, yeah, that we will be good at living in cities because a lot of people will cling to them. It's a sort of refuge against the impoverishment of the countryside, the collapse or the very sharp decline of people working in the countryside. People are forced to cities, again, you know, sometimes against their will, but, you know, they will find a way to survive there. They will find a way to find and make a form of living. So we're good in that sense. And then the much more, you know, bigger scale, I think, you know, it's kind of in our interests to be good city dwellers, to find ways to, you know, make cities much more walkable, pleasant places to live in, much greener, much cooler, all those kind of things I talk about through the book, the pleasures of urban life. You know, they need to be places that we want to be in, we want to enjoy, we want to walk and make our homes and make, just, you know, make the best that we can, always make better, always build better, always recover better. I think it's something that cities have been good at in the past. We, you know, and the urgency couldn't be greater now.
Great point to finish on. My guest today has been Ben Wilson. I strongly recommend Ben's book, Metropolis, A History of Humankind's Greatest Invention. Ben, thanks for being part
Thank
of City Talks.
Thank you very much. That was great.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities or like us on LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission and all rights are reserved.